You're listening to Love and Revolution Radio, covering the heart of change and changes of the heart, featuring stories of ordinary, extraordinary people who are waging struggle for love and revolution. This week on Love and Revolution Radio, we speak with Reverend Bruce Wright, one of the organizers of the 26-year-old Poor People's Economic and Human Rights Campaign, about their recent march from Philadelphia to D.C. and the revival of Dr. King's Resurrection City.
Kwe Aguanu Nidups. Hello and welcome, friends. This is Sherry Mitchell for Love and Revolution Radio. I'm coming to you today from my home in Wabanaki Territory, the Dawn Land, seated along the shores of the beautiful Penobscot River, located in central Maine. And today, as always, I'm joined by my very insightful co-host, Miss Rivera Sun. Hello, Rivera.
Greetings, Sherry. It is a wild time in our world with so much going on and just so many campaigns that we can cover and talk about on the show. But today I'm excited to have a guest speaker who's going to talk about the 26-year-old Poor People's Campaign. Now, a lot of us have been hearing about Reverend Barber's Poor People's Campaign that was launched this year in 30 different states, but this is an older one organized and led by poor people, and Reverend Bruce Wright is going to speak to us about it. He's the co-host of the Revolutionary Roadshow, a radio program that broadcasts out of the Tampa, Florida area. He's also a long-term organizer for the rights of unhoused people, and he runs something called, or he's involved in something called The Refuge, which is an international network of outreaches that work in solidarity with homeless and poor people. I met him in Florida, and I saw his work among those facing homelessness firsthand, and I just want to tell the listeners that it's a real honor to have him on the show with us today. Welcome, Bruce.
Oh, so glad to be on.
Bruce, can you give us a little context for the Poor People's Economic and Human Rights Campaign that you've been involved with for a number of years? Before we even start talking about this recent set of actions that you did, tell us about the organization, what it's been up to, and where it came from.
Yeah, we've been around almost 25 years. We grew out of three movements, essentially. Of course, the historic Poor People's Campaign of Dr. King that began to happen before he passed away and was unfortunately killed by the state. We also grew out of the Welfare Rights Union movement, which is a movement that, you know, existed for many, many years, but grew to larger numbers in the height of welfare reform, as I like to call it. And then we grew out of the homeless movements, such as the National Coalition for the Homeless. So we kind of have some strong historic roots, and of course we've been around for a number of years. Specifically, we grew out of the Kensington Welfare Rights Union, and that was chronicled and spoken about back in the 90s. There was a PBS special called Poverty Outlaw, and there's a well-known book about welfare moms that our coordinator and co-founder Sherry Honkola was featured in. So there's some historic roots to what we are doing and what we're involved in. And it was formed basically by people that were experiencing poverty and homelessness, and particularly welfare mothers. And it was formed with the understanding that the best solutions for poverty, ending poverty and ending homelessness, come from those impacted by it.
There's such a great need right now, not that there hasn't always been, but to distinguish for folks who are listening, those who are out there trying to find a pathway through the multitude of issues that we're all facing to understand the correlation between poverty and some of the other social problems that we have in the world right now. Can you talk a little bit about the correlation between poverty and some of the other issues that we're facing? You know, I'm particularly interested in some of the things that you've done to look at this rise in white nationalism, to look at the correlation between the story of Jesus's parents and the immigration issues that are going on right now. Can you just kind of elaborate a little bit on how those correlations come together and how they can help us to frame the larger picture of what we're seeing in the world right now?
Yeah, there was a book written some time ago, and I want to give special credit to it. Nelson Peary wrote it, and he's with the League of Revolutionaries for a New America. He's passed away, but he wrote a book called Beyond Racial Division to Class Unity. And it kind of speaks to the issue as it relates to white supremacy, as it relates to the whole issue of poverty and homelessness and undocumented workers. And then I'll kind of tie it into my understanding of the Jesus narrative. You know, we have long had an issue of class in this country. And of course, it's been colored more specifically by race and racism, particularly against African slaves who were brought here and African people and indigenous First Nations people, but of course, Latino and Asian and others. And also by gender, whether it's the LGBTQ community or women. And this kind of white supremacy, white male supremacy, white hierarchy that this country was founded on. And, it has been there all along. It's come to, I guess, new heights and new attention because of this current administration. But, I think it's important to point out that this is just the tip of the iceberg, that it has been this way for some time, and that both parties of the oligarchy, of plutocracy, have fostered and perpetuated these divisions. But it's come to new heights with, I guess, white supremacy being emboldened more than it ever has been. But, we must always remind ourselves that even the idea of slavery has never ended, because we have the slavery of undocumented workers. We have the slavery that exists within the prison system, both of which it seems like the 13th and 14th Amendments don't apply. Unfortunately, because it makes provision, especially in the prison system, for using inmates as slave labor. So we have all these things going on. We have this kind of idea that is being perpetuated and promoted, that one class or one race is better than the other, separating people. And so for us, we feel like it's important to recognize that poverty knows no gender or gender identity or age or race or ethnicity. It affects everyone. And there has been for too long this division between poor white people and the rest of those who experience poverty, which is disproportionate, of course. The other thing that's important to point out is that how the Jesus narrative or religion has played a role in this. And it has played a role because there has been this constant group of white evangelical Christians who are seeking power, which, by the way, was not something the early church even purported to believe in or promote. In fact, it eschewed power. It spoke against empire. In fact, to call Jesus Lord meant that you were not calling Caesar Lord. So it was a political statement. And even the nature of who Jesus was. He was born to a teenage mother of an enslaved people, of people of color. Jesus was not white. Jesus was a mixture of African and Arab, and might look quite off, might even look like some of the people we have labeled as terrorists, quite honestly. And in fact, he was killed by the state for the idea of fomenting revolution. That's what he was killed for. The cross was reserved for those kind of situations. And so he was born to an enslaved people. He was didn't have a place to lay his head, so he clearly struggled with homelessness. And his parents were refugees at one point. They had to expatriate to Egypt to flee persecution by the state. So when you factor in all these things, and when you look at the whole notion of poverty movements, and you see the intersectionality of all these groups, you have to begin to wonder why it is that this issue of poverty has been either ignored or so divisive that people are unwilling to address it. And so that's what we're all about at the Poor People's Economic Human Rights Campaign. I know that's kind of a long answer, but
I think it's an important thing to really challenge and transform is this collusion of claiming, politicians particularly, claiming Christian values by and large, and yet enacting policies that are very inherently not in alignment with their proposed faith. I think one of the things that the Poor People's Economic and Human Rights Campaign has really striven to do over the years is to, as the other campaign is saying, reclaim that moral narrative and really lift up the fact that these policies that harm the poor are bad for our nation's soul, as Dr. King pointed out, but they're also actually bad for our nation in a number of other ways. It really takes out the bottom of the economy. In a global economy, it doesn't particularly serve our national economy to have a poorly paid underclass. Not that we should be perpetuating that problem overseas either. But I'm curious to hear some of the tangible goals or the tangible demands that your Poor People's Campaign has lifted up over the years, and perhaps even particularly in this particular set of actions, which we should get to in a moment.
Well, yeah. I mean, there's very specific principles of unity that we govern ourselves by, and it's connected to, you know, how we look at things and the way things should be. Or, you know, how we view things should be done. And, you know, we have basically 16 principles of unity that might help. And I'll try to abbreviate each one, but I think it would be instructive. You know, first principle is that we lift up and support poor people's leadership. We agree to sit down and work on solutions together from the bottom up by those who are impacted. We identify and address the root causes of our poverty. We support the international poor people's movement as we work locally. We're building a movement that enacts a future we want to see, one based on a cooperative economy and society. We organize for power, which means we embrace tactics and strategies that help move the movement towards political independence. We're committed to peace, even as we daily suffer violence, the violence of unemployment, hunger, and homelessness. We have a right and duty to protect our families and each other. We are collectively creating our vision for a different kind of world. We are committed to making and controlling our own media. We recognize the need for a radical break with the status quo of progressive politics. We no longer hold on to the old models of organizing that don't challenge capitalism. We recognize the intersectionality of our oppression, which means that we look at racism, classism, sexism, xenophobia, homophobia, ableism, and transphobia, and look at intersectionality in relation to that. We know the entire global capitalist economy is disrupted and undermined as new laborless electronic technology is applied. And so we understand that workers are cast out and we need to find ways of re-envisioning workers' rights. We acknowledge that this country was built on white supremacy, imperialism, colonialism, and militarism, and we reject all these forms of violence. We break with the prison, military, faith, and nonprofit industrial complexes, and that might be worth expounding on that particular thing. We honor our ancestors and lift up their histories, and we're working to build a poor and working class political leadership and representation. So So from the get-go, the whole idea of what we're about is this notion of horizontal, bottom-up, solidarity-based, not top-down charity, not top-down big-funded, not top-down big money. And, you know, in that one principle, you mentioned the military industrial complex and the prison industrial complex, but we also threw in the faith industrial and nonprofit industrial for a reason, because there is this sense all too often. And you know, I have an undergrad in social work, and I have other degrees as well, but my undergrad, one of the principles we learned in social work is that we're to be thinking in terms of working ourselves out of a job, and that human rights trump anything else in our relation to our work. But too often what has happened with the nonprofit industrial complex is rightly called, although it was originally coined, I guess, to some extent by right-wing people, but it is rightly called out as poverty pimping. And we don't believe in that. We don't believe in exploitation of anyone who is experiencing poverty and homelessness. So for us, those key principles have to be the core of how we see change happen. So I don't know if that gives you, you know, enough of the specifics.
Bruce, can you tell us about some of the recent actions that you've been involved in?
Yes, we just got off the heels of a Four People's March from Philadelphia to Washington, D.C. It was a 10-day event, three of which were spent in Washington, D.C. We went to cities and towns and even rural areas to bring the message of poverty and homelessness from the people impacted. And part of the time was marching. Part of the time was driving to different sites. Different faith-based groups hosted us when we needed to stay overnight. We brought people from all over the country, and we had endorsements and support from all over the world. And it was led by people impacted by poverty and homelessness, including other abled people who were on the march. We also had children. We had people of every race, and we had people of every gender identity. And it was intended to be a situation where the people's voice could be heard. We took over land that we did have a permit for, but we didn't necessarily have a permit to stay overnight. But we did that anyway, although we ended up being evicted. And I can tell you about that story a little later. We also did an action at the HUD office, because at the core of the HUD office in D.C. is ground zero, if you will, in the fight against the poor, in the war on the poor. And we're declaring it's time to stop the war on the poor. So that is our recent kind of thing we've been involved in.
Now, I want to follow up on so many things, but I'm going to start with HUD. This has become the ground zero for one of the serious problems confronting poor people. That we have Ben Carson at the head of the HUD and the Housing Authority, and he is planning to raise Section 8 housing rates quite a bit into a realm that is completely unaffordable for people who can't even afford housing right now. This comes at a time when many, an increasing number of our cities and towns are facing extreme gentrification cycles, and the affordable housing is getting scarcer and scarcer, and rents in general are out of reach for people who even have pretty substantial incomes at this point. Will you speak a little bit more about your focus and approach with HUD, and how this issue is a real impact upon people who are poor right now, and also people who are currently homeless and seeking ways to get back into housing?
Well, you know, the number one issue as it relates to poverty in America mm-hmm. is the issue of housing, and that is creating affordable housing, and how they define what affordable is, and creating situations where it's looked at as a human right as opposed to something that people have to earn, and the demolishing of affordable housing in order to gentrify neighborhoods and communities and push out poor folks. So HUD is the, I guess, hub of which all policies related to housing happen, and really poverty in general in this country. And there was a move towards a very strong idea of housing first, which is the idea that fundamentally, when you're dealing with poverty, when you're dealing with homelessness, housing has to be looked at as the first thing you address as a human right. And that wrapping around services and giving support and all the other things that are necessary can only be done first if someone has housing. I mean, if you think about it, how are you going to get a job if you don't have a place to live? How are you going to get mail if you don't have a place to live? How are you going to get a shower or change your clothes if you don't have a place to live? So fundamentally, that is for us the core issue. And HUD was the, I guess you could say, natural target for this march and for the things that we wanted to bring up related to it.
So many of those things are so deeply intertwined and connected. You know, housing is a critical issue, and it certainly is at the core of many of the issues being faced by the poor around the country. Another issue that is closely correlated to all of that is our abysmal minimum wage. And so if people aren't able to make a living wage and they're not able to afford adequate housing through any type of housing program, there's a recent story that came out that said that people can't rent a two-bedroom apartment in any state in the United States on minimum wage. So if you're someone who has children and you're trying to find affordable housing and you're working at a job where you're receiving minimum wage, then the deck is stacked really high against you being able to succeed in that. So can you talk a little bit about the need for elevation in the minimum wage in order to address some of these issues as well?
Yeah, we have been involved as the Poor People's Economic Human Rights Campaign, and we emphasize the word economic because that's, you know, we base some of that on the model that's stated in the UN Declaration of Human Rights, Articles 23 through 25, which speak to the notion in there, including all the things we've talked about, but also the idea of a job that provides adequate wages in order to have a living. And so we've been involved in living wage movements, including the Fight for 15. And fundamentally, what's not recognized, I think, is that most of those experiencing homelessness and poverty are actually people that want to work, that are working, and in many cases, when they're homeless, are working, but they're just not getting adequate funds. And so for us, that becomes something that we have to speak about and emphasize and put forward the whole struggle related to that. And so, yes, it's critical because if you can't make enough money to make ends meet, then you cannot survive and cover your housing and your electric, your water, your insurance. And unfortunately, because in most cases, in most cities and towns, public transportation is not adequate, so you have to find a way to have transportation as well. So it is the key to getting out of poverty.
I see a inherent hypocrisy in many of the collision of the policies and philosophies espoused by many of our politicians, in which they want people to get jobs, is what we often hear. They want people to contribute to society. They want people to succeed in, whether it's the neoliberal capitalist model or it's the libertarian dream of the free market. And yet they are also completely unwilling to recognize that there are A, inherent injustices within our society that stack the deck against people. The more you wind up on the lower end of the privilege structure in our society, and B, they're not willing to address the fact that social support programs are actually some of the the best intervention mechanisms for justice that allow us to all participate and succeed in those visions of what they want to propose as our society. The third component that they almost never acknowledge is that their vision of society completely relies on having a poor and impoverished class, and in many cases directly and predatorily profits off of that. Can you address this conflict of interest that is inherent in the policy design and the philosophy of economy that our politicians espouse?
Well, yeah, I mean, there's the famous Chicago school and of course, I can't remember his name right now, but, you know, he's like the guru of capitalism that supports this idea that economies should be based on, a meritocracy. And that's the fundamental issue of capitalism. So in order for capitalism to thrive, there's got to be this kind of class division. There's got to be this idea of the worker and the subservience of the worker to the bosses. And, you know, that may sound to some like, oh, that sounds like your classic Marxist analysis. And I would say, well, that's pretty accurate, actually. Even some reformists in capitalism are acknowledging the analysis as being correct. And there is this idea that to perpetuate capitalism, to keep it going, you've got to have those who amass capital at the expense of those who provide the necessary labor for capital to exist. And I hear the arguments all the time. Well, you know, I pulled myself up by my own bootstraps, which is not reality. No one has ever pulled themselves up by just themselves. I mean, just the fact that you drive on an interstate that's funded by the state, you didn't build that interstate yourself. You know, I mean, that's just real simple bottom line analysis there. But the idea that people pull themselves by their own bootstraps is a complete mythology, but it is something that is ingrained in the American dream and the idea of the American dream. So, there's a whole philosophical basis to this that, yes, even poor and working class folks buy into because they keep hoping against hope that they'll get that American dream, whether it's stuff that they hear on television or buying lottery tickets or whatever it is, you know, they're hoping they'll get that break. And that is not the reality that the majority of Americans face. In fact, the actual statistics say, and this is from the U.S. Census Bureau, it's not a, by any means a liberal or even radical group, that 50% of America is now at or below the poverty line. That means half of America is experiencing poverty at some level or pretty close to it.
Bruce, I think that a lot of people are confused oftentimes when they think about poverty. They equate poverty with a lack of willingness to work. And one of the things that it's really important for people to come to understand is that they have to have this whole new view about what poverty actually is. And, when people look really hard, they oftentimes will see that those who are living in poverty work harder and longer hours than those who are not. And so when we think about the causes of poverty, I mean, somebody can be thrown into poverty through illness, through unemployment, student loan debt. There's all kinds of ways for people to arrive in a state of poverty.
We're going to take a quick break for a station ID, and then we'll come right back to this great conversation with Bruce Wright.
Can you talk a little bit about the difference between, well, first I would like you to talk about some of the causes of poverty that people are facing, and also the difference between the definition of poverty and the actual reality for those who are living in poverty within this country.
Yeah, sure. Well, you know, as far as the actual idea of what makes people poor, how does one end up experiencing poverty, there's no one particular cause, but there is, first of all, the idea that you don't make enough to cover everything you have to pay for. I'm saying have to pay for. It's not, and one could argue even the positive pleasure things in life should be factored in, because to be a fully, human person, I don't know if I want to put it that way, but everything in life needs to be experienced, including art and beauty. So I don't think that should be ignored. But when we're talking poverty at its core, though, we're talking about the inability to afford to pay your housing, your electric, your water, your insurance, your food, the basic necessities, clothing of life. And one experiences poverty for a variety of reasons, but it's not because they're bad. It's not because they've done something wrong. It's not because they're not hard workers. Some of the most hardworking and giving people I know are people struggling with poverty. And those of us who have been in that situation, and I still am to some extent, but I'm formerly homeless myself, we understand what it is to work in community with one another to survive, to create this kind of collectiveness and collectivity in order for you to survive and create these networks. People experience poverty because of natural disasters. They experience poverty because of growing up in it from the prior family. They experience poverty because of a catastrophe, health-wise, mental or physical, because of an addictions issue, because of a divorce, because of domestic violence. So there's no one cause. And the definition of poverty, as the federal guidelines define it, is wholly inadequate, because it's trying, the current definition is somewhere around $25,000 a year for a family of four. Well, let me tell you, that's extreme poverty. That's not just poverty. Because if a family of four is trying to survive on $25,000 a year, for the most part, they are either in a hotel or near homelessness, street homelessness. It's much, much more realistic to say that a family of four, especially in the Northeast and West Coast and to some extent the Midwest, maybe not so much in the South, but a family of four that's bringing in $50,000 a year is near poverty, near homelessness. And people hear those numbers and say, wow, $50,000, that sounds great. But, you know, maybe in rural Tennessee, a family of four could make it on that, but certainly not any of the major cities in this country, especially in the Northeast, Midwest, or West Coast. So our definitions of poverty are very skewed, because the government gives one figure for the entire country. And the absurdity about that is that it's just not that way. Well, there's not a universal number, because it's very much, there's a minimum number. And I would say at this point, a family of four making $50,000 a year is in a situation where they are experiencing poverty. And the only places that may not be true would be some rural areas where it's still expensive to live. But then the problem is you can't make that kind of money in those rural areas, so you're relegated to minimum wage jobs. So ultimately, guess what? You're in the same boat.
I think when we look at that number you quoted from the Census Bureau, that 50% of us are living in poverty, one of the things that some of the statistics really do take into account is the cost of living compared to relative income levels for families. And what we find in the U.S. is that the cost of living for people is outstripping very rapidly their income. And when that's paired with debt, whether it be student debt or medical debt or other types of debt that people have, we're all, obviously, from that statistic, there's 50% of us who are having extreme difficulty making ends meet, as we say. And when you talk about the $50,000 a year statistic, two things come to mind for me. One is that as someone who has lived in California and knows firsthand that if you have a family, you're looking at upwards over $2,500 a month for your rent. That's very quickly 50% of your income when our housing costs to be sustainable should be less than or at one third of our income levels. I think the other thing we need to really look at in the context of all this is that we are not a poor country. We are one of the wealthiest countries in the world. And if we took the gross national income and divided it equally, just on a, you know, crunching numbers perspective, between all 230 million people in this country, every man, woman, and child would be making $60,000 a year. A family of four would be making $240,000 a year. And that's not even looking at the wealth, it's only looking at the income levels. So, you know, we have the money to be more just in our society. We have the capacity as a culture and a society to really be more fair, more just, more compassionate, more respectful. I think even more than compassionate, when we look at these numbers, what we're looking at is a situation of disrespect towards our fellow citizens. So, Bruce, what I want to ask about is one of your principles, and this gets into solutions thinking. And one of the things that intrigued me to talk to you on this show is that the principles of the Poor People's Economic and Human Rights Campaign are radically different than most of the campaigning we see around poor people's rights. We brought up the fact that there is another Poor People's Campaign going on right now. It's challenging the legislators on a moral narrative note. It's bringing up a lot of intertwined issues. But one thing I haven't really seen it really take on is capitalism itself. And the, as you said, the fact that the status quo of progressive politics needs a radical revisioning, not just a challenge, but a radical revisioning. So I'd like to ask you about the principle of the cooperative economy. Why is this so important? How does it work? And what is the vision that the poor people and the people involved in your Poor People's Economic and Human Rights Campaign have for this cooperative economy?
Well, it's based on the principle of collectivity and sharing of power and the idea of it being horizontal and bottom up. It's based on the idea of the means of production. And, well, I guess it does sound Marxist, but we believe in the idea. And it's even a spiritual principle that existed in the early church and actually has existed in indigenous cultures for thousands of years. And that's economies of scale. At local levels, even at a larger level, collectively owned by the worker. And also the idea of creating alternative economies, you know, that, for instance, co-ops and local growing of foods and creating cooperative banks and things of that nature. So there's a very practical level to it. And again, it's owned collectively. We have in our principles a belief that capitalism cannot be reformed, that it's parasitic. It always has been because it's always been about amassing capital. That's its bottom line. So its ethic is based on that. And it was honed, if you will, and moved to new levels philosophically by the Chicago School of Business, and I still can't remember that gentleman's name. Maybe one of you all remember his name. And then Ayn Rand and her whole philosophy. And it's a very self-centered kind of philosophy. And we reject that. You can't reform something that by its nature, that's what it's about. But one of the fundamental problems with a lot of the other poverty movements is that they are tied into the political system. one of the things you're hearing a lot about is demonizing Republicans and Trump. And while there's a lot to demonize with both, there's plenty to demonize with the Democrats as much. And I don't know if I want to use the word demonize, but, you know, it's the idea that there's a certain few that benefit on the backs of the poor, and they want to keep it going, even if they want to make it nicer. They want to make it a nicer slave master that gives them housing in the mansion instead of out in the field. You know, Malcolm X talked about that a lot.
Bruce, one of the things that you talked about was, this communal sort of sharing of power. But I also think when you talk about indigenous communities having understood sharing of power, it also really comes down to our basic value models, that we have these basic value structures that are all tied to economy. And that's purposefully been done, that we have all of our values and are tied to this economic model. The ways that we see the world are tied to an economic model. And I think that there needs to be a change in basic value structure for people. And I certainly think that we also need to look at how we're living, because one of the things that is true under colonization, this settler ideologies and capitalism, is that we've come to live very individualized lives. And so when we're not sharing housing, when we're not sharing food, when we're not sharing other resources, it's much more costly for us to live. And so I'm thinking about, how do we encourage a shift in the way that we're living, our basic way of life and the way that we see the world? Because the system as it is structured to do exactly what it's doing. It's structured to keep people in poverty, to keep people in the state of indentured servitude, so that a few at the top can, benefit from that scenario. And so how do we extricate ourselves completely from these ways of being and start taking responsibility ourselves for creating a more communal way of being in the world and in relationship to one another to help eradicate some of these things in our own communities? Is there a way for us to do that?
Well, I think one of the things we have to do is we have to lay out the principles, number one. Number two, we have to acknowledge that these ideas must come from those who've experienced the struggle firsthand, and not just from think tanks or pundits or politicians or wealthy entrepreneurs, which is the model that's most often thought of. I think the next thing we have to do is have clear principles of how that would happen. And then we need to begin to do it, as in model it at local levels, and then build from local to regional to national, again, a bottom up. But there has to be national policies that back that up. But the national policies have to be put into place by movements, not by electing our way into it. I'm not against electoral politics, but what I find is that most often both parties, and I'll say in particular the Democrats, will play to the poor, particularly poor people of color, and say they're going to do this, that, and the other, but they never do. This is why 50% of America doesn't vote, period. So you have 25% or 26%, let's say, versus 24% that lost, and then the remaining 50% that didn't vote at all. So 25% of the population deciding the fate of everyone else, at the best. Probably even less than that if you look at votes that aren't counted or disenfranchised or the effect of the Electoral College. So we get a small minority of people deciding the fate of all of us. So the only way to correct that is not by electing our way into it. It's by forcing those in power to have to do the right thing. I mean, that's what the civil rights movement did. That's what the anti-war movement did. And it wasn't because they elected someone. I mean, the height of the Vietnam War, Johnson was president. The height of the struggle against poverty, Johnson enacted this poverty program, but he was essentially forced into it kicking and screaming, as was the Congress. So I don't think you have to have the right kind of people in office as much as you have to have the power of the people from the bottom up that forces people to do the right thing. And people don't realize their collective power yet. And I know, Rivera, you've written a lot about that, especially in your fictional novels, the power of numbers from the bottom up, and even small numbers, relatively speaking, which I know Gene Sharp talks a bit about. So it can be done, but we have to look at all these factors.
I think that's one of the things that I appreciate about your Poor People's Economic and Human Rights campaign is that it doesn't subscribe to the ideology that we should give our power away and put it into the hands of legislators exclusively. It acknowledges that that's a one front of the multi-fronted struggle, that we can't ignore this aspect of our society that has amassed quite a bit of power. But when it comes to resolving these issues, we need to look at the corporations. We need to look at our friends and neighbors and their attitudes about poverty and the poor. We need to look at the cultural ways that we relate to economy and individualism versus shared economies. We need to look at all these different aspects. I mean, we mentioned the nonprofit industrial complexes, basically profiteering off the perpetual cycles of poverty. But also, you know, I know as a minister, you've challenged and confronted the fact that many churches also do this same thing, that they alleviate the conditions of poverty, which is a fairly Christian outlook. But they fail to turn over the money lenders' tables, so to speak, and they fail to really challenge the systemic and structural causes of poverty within our society. I wanted to kind of pivot the conversation and go back to the recent campaigns that just happened, the March to DC, and then you also resurrected, so to speak, the Resurrection City and did Occupy in DC, which ended with an eviction on Monday, in which I believe Sherry Honkola was arrested as part of that. Can you tell us a little bit about that choice of tactic, what happened, and perhaps, from my vantage point, it was a direct embodiment. It wasn't symbolic at all, but a direct embodiment of the realities faced by poor, particularly homeless people all over the country, that we don't even have a right to stand, to sit, to be, to exist, and in the case that came up in DC, to assemble and to petition for redress of grievances. So will you speak a little bit more about what happened there?
Yes, we had a permit, but they attempted, as in the police, to define what the permit is. And it violated several things, including freedom of assembly, the Fourth Amendment, First Amendment, freedom of religion, all of those things. Because we were expressing ourselves in multiple ways, and we had a vigil going on. And the state does not have a right to define what a vigil is, but they, in essence, did. And evicted us. We had tents set up. We were occupying the land. We even had a permit, but the permit was very, very open in its interpretation. And therefore, and court of law, and I'm no lawyer, but our lawyer actually told us this, how we defined it in a broader way is legally defensible and right, but they narrowly defined it and evicted us. As part of that action, we believe it was in retaliation for an earlier action of a civil disobedience we did in the HUD offices in which Sherry got arrested. We demanded a meeting, not just with a PR person who tried to meet with us outside the building. We demanded a meeting inside the building with Ben Carson or one of his direct higher-ups to redress our grievances. Now, anybody can go in there and meet with someone, even if they don't have an appointment. And we knew that that was clearly possible to accommodate without any real difficulty what we were asking for. And so most everyone was kind of forced out of the building, but Sherry stayed there as an act of civil disobedience, which we documented. You can go actually to Revolutionary Road Radio Show's Facebook page and or Poor People's Economic Human Rights Campaign's website, and you'll see actual event that happened that morning, and then that night is when the eviction happened, which we also have documented on video. And it underscores directly what we are talking about. And that is that around the country, even as we speak now, homeless encampments, people who have set up camp in public places, whether it's in the woods or in parks, are being forcibly evicted from the commons, if you will. And not dissimilar to Occupy, but this has been something that's been going on forever, before Occupy even existed, and that is the idea of settling on land and not moving and not allowing yourself to be moved. And it could be argued that the reverse, too, of reoccupying, in the case of indigenous people, reoccupying land that was already theirs. So, yeah, this is not just a symbolic action. We don't prearrange arrests with the police, which often is what's happening now, being called civil disobedience, because it's not disobedience. It's arranged with the police ahead of time.
What are some of the things that you would recommend for people to do in their own communities to get involved and to create awareness and to provide support for those who are living in poverty and who are attempting to create awareness around the type of poverty that exists in their communities? Because I think, you know, like you said, there is no one size fits all for this problem that we're trying to deal with in the world. And I think that, you know, we can talk about statistics, we can talk about legislation, we can talk about all of these other things, but what are the real practical things that people on the ground can do to get involved and to help out?
Well, look for solidarity-based models that exist. You know, refuge ministries, poor people's economic human rights campaign, food not bombs, some of the anarchist collectives that may exist, or the Catholic worker in different cities. Get involved with them. Go and hang out with people in the welfare offices, in the Social Security offices, on the streets, in the parks, and just talk to people. I mean, just like you would your friends, develop relationships, clear out of your head the idea of feeding people. It almost sounds degrading to use that word. And we all are guilty of it. I slip into it myself. Think more in terms of sharing, meal sharing, food sharing, skill sharing, clothing sharing, creating cooperative housing, working with people that already are doing it. You know, they can certainly contact our organizations and get ideas as well. But I think the key is seeking out opportunity to build relationships and work alongside. And it works. I mean, you get examples all over the world, like the MST, Landless Peasant Movement in Brazil, where 3 million people own 3 million acres collectively. The Zapatistas in Mexico, the group in Spain, and it's escaping me right now, that lead and run collective operation.
Mondragon.
Yes. So it can be done. There's examples all over the world, and there's groups you can plug in with.
Well, Bruce, I'm glad you brought up all those specific examples. I think when we look at some of our most successful movements, we also see those kind of examples showing up. We had Gandhian Constructive Program, for example, directly intervening in the economic conditions the Indian people were struggling in a way that undermined the British authority. We also have the example of Cesar Chavez's Farm Workers Credit Union. And we see these again and again because we know to organize struggle requires transforming ourselves, but it also means we need to actually institute structures and systems that support us in living and in existing while we challenge and confront these injustices. I want to thank you so much for joining us on the show. As someone who has lived in poverty before in my life, I think none of us are exempt for that on this show. And as someone who has actually done some acts of civil disobedience to stop homeless hate laws in my own local town, I really appreciate the depth to which you analyze the issues and the ways that people are coming together to propose solutions from their own experiences. I want to just make sure that we take a moment to let listeners know where they can connect with the Poor People's Economic and Human Rights campaigns, and if there's any projects brewing. I know you just got off this march, but if there's anything brewing that's coming up that you want to give a shout out about.
Sure. They can reach us through economichumanrights.org. You can also look up The Refuge on Facebook, Refuge in Florida, that is. And my email is refugestpete@gmail.com. That's refugestpete@gmail.com. My number is 727-278-1547. And we have a number of projects. Of course, we have ongoing work with cooperative housing. Some of the people that went on the march are moving up to our place in Tennessee. We've been blessed with a house that we're forming a cooperative housing situation there. We have a cooperative housing situation going on in St. Pete and some other cities across the country that people can plug into with the Poor People's Economic Human Rights Campaign at our home base in Philly. There is a garden and cooperative housing happening there. We are also going to be involved in a huge anti-war effort because the linkages between poverty and war cannot be underestimated. This November is the 100th anniversary of Armistice Day. It was supposed to be the war to end all wars. Trump is trying to do a huge military parade. We're going to do a counter demonstration, and we're going to bring poverty very much to the forefront of it because war is all about a war on the poor.
Bruce, thank you so much for joining us today and for helping our listeners to become a little bit more aware of some of these really critical issues. As Rivera said, there's nobody on this show today who hasn't faced some poverty in their own life and know the difficulty of trying to move beyond it when some of the things that you need most critically to do that are denied to you because of the circumstances that you find yourself in. So thank you so much for being with us and for doing the work that you're doing out in the world.
Thank you. I'm so glad to be on. Love this show.
I need you to be love, 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 love and revolution.
Thanks this week to our guest, Reverend Bruce Wright, and to Sherry for bringing up the issues of Indigenous sovereignty and the depth of systemic issues that underlie poverty in this country. You can find more about this Poor People's Economic and Human Rights Campaign at economichumanrights.org. Our theme song is Love and Revolution, with words and music by Diane Patterson and performed by her and Spirit Radio. You can find that music at www.dianepatterson.org.
I'd also like to thank my co-host, Rivera Sun, for the perspective that she brings to these discussions each week. If you enjoyed this show today, you might also enjoy following Rivera and I on our individual websites and Facebook pages. My website can be found at www.sacredinstructions.life, and Rivera's website can be found at www.riverasun.com. You can find more information about what we are each doing out in the world beyond the airwaves on these pages. Links to these websites and our Facebook pages can also be found on the podcast link. Love and Revolution Radio is a weekly radio program, and your local radio station can broadcast it. To make this happen, all you have to do is call them and ask them to put us into their rotation. You can reach us via the Love and Revolution page, which can be found through either of our websites and on the Love and Revolution Facebook page. We are Love and Revolution Radio on Podomatic, Stitcher, SoundCloud, and iTunes.
For Love and Revolution Radio, I'm Rivera Sun. The Poor People's Economic and Human Rights Campaign just walked 140 miles from Philadelphia to D.C., and with the rising challenges and oppression facing more and more poor people, which is up to 50% of us in the U.S., perhaps, listeners, you'll look around and find one step that you can take towards economic justice by the time we talk to you next week.